Chapter 7. Approaching Hela, 26:15. Like a golden snowflake, the scavenger's daughter fell through the dusty vacuum of interplanetary space. Quaish had left Morwenna 3 hours earlier. His message to the Queen Commander of the Gnostic Ascension, a sinuous thread of photons snaking through interplanetary space, was still on its way. He thought of the lights of a distant train moving across a dark, dark continent. The enormous distance separating him from other sentient beings was enough to make him shudder. But he had been in worse situations, and at least this time there was a distinct hope of success. The bridge on Hela was still there. It had not turned out to be a mirage of the senses or his own desperate yearning to find something, and the closer he got, the less likely it was that the bridge would turn out to be anything other than a genuine technological artifact. Quaish had seen some deceptive things in his time. Geology that looked as if it had been designed, lovingly sculpted, or mass-produced. But he had never seen anything remotely like this. His instinct said that geology had not been the culprit. But he was having serious trouble with the question of who, or what, had created it. Because the fact remained that 107 Piscium system appeared not to have been visited by anyone else. He shivered in awe and fear, and reckless expectation. He felt the indoctrinal virus awaken in his blood, a monster turning over in its sleep, opening one dreamy eye. It was always there, always within him, but for much of the time it slept, disturbing neither his dreams nor his waking moments. When it engorged him, when it roared in his veins like a distant report of thunder, he would see and hear things. He would glimpse stained glass windows in the sky. He would hear organ music beneath the subsonic growl of each burst of correctional thrust from his tiny, jewel-like exploration ship. Quaish forced calm. The last thing he needed now was the indoctrinal virus having its way with him. Let it come to him later, when he was safe and sound back aboard the Dominatrix. Then it could turn him into any kind of drooling, mumbling idiot it wished. But not here, not now, not while he needed total clarity of mind. The monster yawned, returned to sleep. Quaish was relieved. His faltering control over the virus was still there. He let his thoughts creep back to the bridge, cautiously this time, trying to avoid succumbing to the reverential cosmic chill that had wakened the virus. Could he really rule out human builders? Wherever they went, humans left junk. Their ships spewed out radioisotopes, leaving twinkling smears across the faces of moons and worlds. Their pressure suits and habitats leaked atoms, leaving ghost atmospheres around otherwise airless bodies. The partial pressures of the constituent gases were always a dead giveaway. They left navigation transponders, servitors, fuel cells, and waste products. You found their frozen piss, little yellow snowballs, forming miniature ring systems around planets. You found corpses, and now and then, more often than Quaish would have expected, they were murder victims. It was not always easy, but Quaish had developed a nose for the signs. He knew the right places to look, and he wasn't finding much evidence for prior human presence around 107 Piscium. But someone had built that bridge. It might have been put there hundreds of years ago, he thought. Some of the usual signs of human presence would have been erased by now. But something would have remained, unless the bridge builders had been extraordinarily careful to clean up after themselves. He had never heard of anyone doing such a thing on this scale. And why bury it so far from the usual centers of commerce? Even if people did occasionally visit 107 Piscium system, it was definitely not on the usual trade routes. Didn't these artists want anyone to see what they had created? Perhaps that had always been the intention, just to leave it here, twinkling under the starlight of 107 Piscium until someone found it by accident. Perhaps even now Quaish was an unwilling participant in a century-spanning cosmic jest. But he didn't think so. What he was certain of was that it would have been a dreadful mistake to tell Jasmina more than he had. He had, fortunately, resisted the huge temptation to prove his worth. Now, when he did report back with something remarkable, he would appear to have behaved with the utmost restraint. No, his final message had been exquisite in its brevity. He was quite proud of himself. The virus woke now, stirred perhaps by that fatal pride. He should have kept his emotions in check, but it was too late. It had simmered beyond the point where it would damp down naturally. However, it was too early to tell if this was going to be a major attack. Just to placate it, he mumbled a little Latin. Sometimes, if he anticipated the virus's demands, the attack would be less serious. He forced his attention back to Haldora, like a drunkard trying to maintain a clear line of thought. It was strange to be falling towards a world he had named himself. Nomenclature was a difficult business in an interstellar culture limited by speed-of-light links. All major craft carried databases of the worlds and minor bodies orbiting different stars. In the core systems, those within a dozen or so light-years of Earth, it was easy enough to stick to the names assigned centuries earlier, during the first wave of interstellar exploration. But once you got further out into virgin territory, the whole business became complicated and messy. The dominatrix said the worlds around 107 Pishium had never been named, but all that meant was that there were no assigned names in the ship's database. That database, however, might not have been seriously updated for decades. Rather than relying on transmissions to and from some central authority, the anarchistic ultras preferred direct ship-to-ship contact. When two or more of their lighthuggers met, they would compare and update their respective nomenclature tables. If the first ship had assigned names to a group of worlds and their associated geographical features, and the second ship had no current entries for those bodies, it was usual for the second ship to amend its database with the new names. They might be flagged as provisional, unless a third ship confirmed that they were still unallocated. If two ships had conflicting entries, their databases would be updated simultaneously, listing two equally likely names for each entry. If three or more ships had conflicting entries, the various entries would be compared in case two or more had precedence over a third. In that case, the deprecated entry would be erased or stored in a secondary field reserved for questionable or unofficial designations. If a system had truly been named for the first time, then the newly assigned names would gradually colonize the databases of most ships, though it might take decades for that to happen. Quaish's tables were only as accurate as the Gnostic Ascension's. Jasmina was not a gregarious ultra, so it was possible that this system had been named already. If that were the case, his own lovingly assigned names would be gradually weeded out of existence until they remained only as ghost entries at the lowest level of deprecation in ship databases, or were erased entirely. But for now, and perhaps for years to come, the system was his. Haldora was the name he had given this world, and until he learned otherwise it was as official as any other, except that, as Morwenna had pointed out, all he had really done was grab unallocated names from the nomenclature tables and flung them at anything that looked vaguely appropriate. If the system did indeed turn out to be important, did it not behoove him to take a little more care over the process? Who knew what pilgrimages might end here if his bridge turned out to be real? Quaish smiled. The names were good enough for now. If he decided he wanted to change them, he still had plenty of time. He checked his range to Hela, just over 150,000 kilometers. From a distance, the illuminated face of the moon had been a flat disk the color of dirty ice, streaked here and there with pastel shades of pumice, ochre, pale blue and faint turquoise. Now that he was closer, the disk had taken on a distinct three-dimensionality, bulging out to meet him like a blind human eye. Hela was small only by the standards of terrestrial worlds. For a moon it was respectable enough, 3,000 kilometers from pole to pole, with a mean density that put it at the upper range of the moons that Quaish had encountered. It was spherical and largely devoid of impact craters, no atmosphere to speak of, but plenty of surface topology hinting at recent geological processes. At first glance it had appeared to be tidally locked to Haldora, always presenting the same face to its mother world, but the mapping software had quickly detected a tiny residual rotation. Had it been tidally locked, the moon's rotation period would have been exactly the same as the time it took to make one orbit, 40 hours. Earth's moon was like that, and so were many of the moons Quaish had spent time on. If you stood at a given spot on their surface, then the larger world around which they orbited, be it Earth or a gas giant like Haldora, always hung at about the same place in the sky. But Hela wasn't like that. Even if you found a spot on Hela's equator where Haldora was sitting directly overhead, swallowing 20 degrees of sky, Haldora would drift. In 1 40-hour orbit, it would move by nearly 2 degrees. In 80 standard days, just over 2 standard months, Haldora would be sinking below Hela's horizon. 160 days later, it would begin to peep over the opposite horizon. After 320 days, it would be back at the beginning of the cycle, directly overhead. The error in Hela's rotation, the deviation away from a true tidally locked period, was only 1 part in 200. Tidal locking was an inevitable result of frictional forces between 2 nearby orbiting bodies, but it was a grindingly slow process. It might be that Hela was still slowing down, not yet having reached its locked configuration, or it might be that something had jolted it in the recent past, a glancing collision from another body, perhaps. Still another possibility was that the orbit had been perturbed by a gravitational interaction with a massive third body. All these possibilities were reasonable, given Quaish's ignorance of the system's history, but at the same time the imperfection affronted him. It was as annoying as a clock that kept almost perfect time. It was the kind of thing he would have imagined pointing to if anyone had ever argued that the cosmos must be the result of divine conception. Would a creator have permitted such a thing, when all it would have taken was a tiny nudge to set the world to rights? The virus simmered, boiling higher in his blood. It didn't like that kind of thinking. He snapped his thoughts back to the safe subject of Hela's topography, wondering if he might make some sense of the bridge from its context. The bridge was aligned more or less east to west, as defined by Hela's rotation. It was situated very near the equator, spanning the gash that was the world's most immediately obvious geographic feature. The gash began near the northern pole, cutting diagonally from north to south across the equator. It was at its widest and deepest near the equator, but it was still fearfully impressive many hundreds of kilometers north or south of that point. Ginnungagap Rift, he had named it. The rift sloped from northeast to southwest. To its west in the northern hemisphere was an upraised geologically complex region that he had named the Western Hyrrokin Uplands. The Eastern Hyrrokin Uplands curled around the pole to flank the rift on its other side. South of the western range, but still above the equator, was the zone that Quaish had elected to call Glisten Heath Ridge. South of the equator was another upraised area named the Gullaveg Range. To the west, straddling the tropics, Quaish identified Mount Gudbrand, the Calder Flats, the Vigrid Badlands, Mount Jord. To Quaish, these names conveyed a dizzying sense of antiquity, a feeling that this world already had a richly textured past, a frontier history of epic expeditions and harrowing crossings, a history populated by the brave and the bold. Inevitably, however, his attention returned to Ginnungagap Rift and the bridge that spanned it. The details were still unclear, but the bridge was obviously too complicated, too artful and delicate, to be just a tongue of land left behind by some erosive process. It had been built there, and it did not appear as if humans had had much to do with it. It was not that it was beyond human ingenuity. Humans had achieved many things in the last 1,000 years, and throwing a bridge across a 40-kilometer-wide abyss, even a bridge as cleanly elegant as the one that spanned Ginnungagap Rift, would not be amongst the most audacious of those achievements. But just because humans could have done it, did not mean that they had. This was Hela. This was as far out in the sticks as it was possible to be. No human had any business building bridges here. But aliens? Now that was a different matter. It was true that in 600 years of space travel, nothing remotely resembling an intelligent, tool-using technological culture had ever been encountered by humankind. But they had been out there once. Their ruins dotted dozens of worlds. Not just one culture either, but 8 or 9 of them. And that was only the tally in the little huddle of systems within a few dozen light-years of the first system. There was no guessing how many hundreds or thousands of dead cultures had left their mark across the wider galaxy. What kind of culture might have lived on Hela? Had they evolved on this icy moon, or had it just been a stopover point in some ancient forgotten diaspora? What were they like? Were they one of the known cultures? He was getting ahead of himself. These were questions for later, when he had surveyed the bridge and determined its composition and age. Closer in, he might well find other things that the sensors were missing at this range. There might be artifacts that unequivocally linked the Hela culture to one that had already been studied elsewhere, or the artifacts might cinch the case the other way, an utterly new culture, never encountered before. It didn't matter. Either way, the find was of incalculable value. Jasmina could control access to it for decades to come. It would give her back the prestige she had lost over the last few decades. For all that he had disappointed her, Quaich was certain she would find a way to reward him for that. Something chimed on the console of the scavenger's daughter. For the first time, the probing radar had picked up an echo. There was something metallic down there. It was small, tucked away in the depths of the rift, very near the bridge. Quaich adjusted the radar, made sure that the echo was genuine. It did not vanish. He had not seen it before, but it would have been at the limit of his sensor range until now. The dominatrix would have missed it entirely. He didn't like it. He had convinced himself that there had never been a human presence out here, and now he was getting exactly the sort of signature he would have expected from discarded junk. "Be careful," he said to himself. On an earlier mission, he had been approaching a moon a little smaller than Hela. There had been something on it that enticed him, and he had advanced incautiously. Near the surface, he had picked up a radar echo similar to this one, a glint of something down there. He had pushed on, ignoring his better instincts. The thing had turned out to be a booby trap. A particle cannon had popped out of the ice and locked onto his ship. Its beam had chewed holes in the ship's armor, nearly frying Quaich in the process. He had made it back to safety, but not before sustaining nearly fatal damage to both the ship and himself. He had recovered, and the ship had been repaired, but for years afterwards he had been wary of similar traps. Things got left behind. Automated sentries, plonked down on worlds centuries earlier to defend property claims or mining rights. Sometimes they kept on working long after their original owners were dust. Quaich had been lucky. The sentry, or whatever it was, had been damaged, its beam less powerful than it had once been. He had got off with a warning, a reminder not to assume anything. And now he was in serious danger of making the same mistake again. He reviewed his options. The presence of a metallic echo was dispiriting, making him doubtful that the bridge was as ancient and alien as he had hoped. But he would not know until he was closer, and that would mean approaching the source of the echo. If it was indeed a waiting sentry, he would be placing himself in harm's way. But, he reminded himself, the scavenger's daughter was a good ship, nimble, smart, and well-armored. She was crammed with intelligence and guile. Reflexes were not much use against a relativistic weapon like a particle beam, but the daughter would be monitoring the source of the echo all the while, just in case there was some movement before firing. The instant the ship saw anything she found alarming, she would execute a high-G random evasion pattern designed to prevent the beam weapon from predicting its position. The ship knew the precise physiological tolerances of Quaich's body and was prepared nearly to kill him in the interests of his ultimate survival. If she got really annoyed, she would deploy micro-defenses of her own. "I'm all right," Quaich said aloud. "I can go deeper and still come out of this laughing. I'm sorted." But he had to consider Morwenna as well. The dominatrix was further away, granted, but it was slower and less responsive. It would be a stretch for a beam weapon to take out the dominatrix, but it was not impossible. And there were other weapons that a sentry might deploy, such as hunter-seeker missiles. There might even be a distributed network of the things, talking to each other. Hell, he thought, it might not even be a sentry. It might just be a metal-rich boulder or a discarded fuel tank. But he had to assume the very worst. He needed to keep Morwenna alive. Equally, he needed the dominatrix to be able to get back to Jasmina. He could not risk losing either his lover or the ship that was now her extended prison. Somehow he had either to protect both of them or give up now. He was not in the mood to give up, but how was he going to safeguard his ticket out of there and his lover without waiting hours for them to get a safe distance away from Hela? Of course. The answer was obvious. It was, almost, staring him in the face. It was beautifully simple and it made elegant use of local resources. Why had he not thought of it sooner? All he had to do was hide them behind Haldora. He made the necessary arrangements, then opened the communications channel back to Morwenna. Ararat, 2675. Vasco observed the approach to the main island with great interest. They had been flying over Black Ocean for so long that it was a relief to see any evidence of human presence. Yet at the same time the lights of the outlying settlements, strung out in the filaments, arcs and loops that implied half-familiar bays, peninsulas and tiny islands, looked astonishingly fragile and evanescent. Even when the brighter outlying sprawls of First Camp came into view, they still looked as if they could be quenched at any moment, no more permanent or meaningful than a fading pattern of bonfire embers. Vasco had always known that the human presence on Ararat was insecure, something that could never be taken for granted. It had been drummed into him since he was tiny, but until now he had never felt it viscerally. He had created a window for himself in the hull of the shuttle, using his fingertip to sketch out the area he wanted to become transparent. Clavain had shown him how to do that, demonstrating the trick with something close to pride. Vasco suspected that the hull still looked perfectly black from the outside, and that he was really looking at a form of screen which exactly mimicked the optical properties of glass. But where old technology was concerned, and the shuttle was very definitely old technology, it never paid to take anything for granted. All he knew for certain was that he was flying, and that he knew of none amongst his peers who had ever done that before. The shuttle had homed in on the signal from Scorpio's bracelet. Vasco had watched it descend out of the cloud layer attended by spirals and curlicues of disturbed air. Red and green lights had blinked on either side of a hull of polished obsidian that had the deltoid concave look of a manta ray. At least a third of the surface area of the underside had been painfully bright, grids of actinically bright, fractally folded thermal elements hazed in a cocoon of flickering purple indigo plasma. Elaborate clawed undercarriage had emerged from the cool spots on the underside, unfolding and elongating in a hypnotic ballet of pistons and hinges. Neon patterns had flicked on in the upper hull, delineating access hatches, hotspots, and exhaust apertures. The shuttle had picked its landing zone, rotating and touching down with dainty precision, the undercarriage contracting to absorb the weight of the craft. For a moment the roar of the plasma heaters had remained, before stopping with unnerving suddenness. The plasma had dissipated, leaving only a nasty, charred smell. Vasco had caught glimpses of the colony's aircraft before, but only from a distance. This was the most impressive thing he had seen. The three of them had walked towards the boarding ramp. They had almost reached it when Clavain misjudged his footfall and began to tumble towards the rocks. Vasco and the pig had both lurched forward at the same time, but it was Vasco who had taken the brunt of Clavain's weight. There had been a moment of relief and shock. Clavain had felt terribly light, like a sack of straw. Vasco's intake of breath had been loud, distinct even above the kettle-like hissing of the transport. "Are you all right, sir?" he had asked. Clavain had looked at him sharply. "I'm an old man," he had replied. "You mustn't expect the world of me." Reflecting now on his past few hours in Clavain's presence, Vasco had no idea what to make of him. One minute the old man was showing him around the shuttle with a kind of avuncular hospitality, asking him about his family, complimenting him on the perspicacity of his questions, sharing jokes with him in the manner of a long-term confidant. The next minute he was as icy and distant as a comet. Though the mood swings came without warning, they were always accompanied by a perceptible shift of focus in Clavain's eyes, as if what was taking place around him had suddenly ceased to be of significant interest. The first few times that this happened, Vasco had naturally assumed that he had done something to displease the old man. But it quickly became apparent that Scorpio was getting the same treatment, and that Clavain's distant phases had less to do with anger than with the loss of a signal, like a radio losing its frequency lock. He was drifting, then snapping back to the present. Once that realization had dawned, Vasco stopped worrying so much about what he said and did in Clavain's presence. At the same time, he found himself more and more concerned about the state of mind of the man they were bringing home. He wondered what kind of place Clavain was drifting to when he stopped being present. When the man was friendly and focused on the here and now, he was as sane as anyone Vasco had met. But sanity, Vasco decided, was like the pattern of lights he could see through his cabin window. In almost any direction, the only way to travel was into darkness, and there was a lot more darkness than light. Now he noticed a strange absence of illumination cutting through the lights of one of the larger settlements. He frowned, trying to think of somewhere he knew where there was an unlit thoroughfare, or perhaps a wide canal cutting back into one of the islands. The shuttle banked, changing his angle of view. The swathe of darkness tilted, swallowing more lights and revealing others. Vasco's perceptions flipped, and he realized that he was seeing an unlit structure interposed between the shuttle and the settlement. The structure's immensely tall shape was only vaguely implied by the way it eclipsed and revealed the background lights, but once Vasco had identified it, he had no trouble filling in the details for himself. It was the Sea Tower, of course. It rose from the sea several kilometers out from the oldest of the settlements, the place where he had been born. The Sea Tower. The ship. Nostalgia for infinity. He had only ever seen it from a distance, for routine sea traffic was forbidden close to the ship. He knew that the leaders sailed out to it, and it was no secret that shuttles occasionally entered or left the ship, tiny as gnats against the gnarled and weathered spire of the visible hull. He supposed Scorpio would know all about that, but the ship was one of the many topics Vasco had decided it would be best not to raise during his first outing with the pig. From this vantage point, the nostalgia for infinity still looked large to Vasco, but no longer quite as distant and geologically huge as it had done for most of his life. He could see that the ship was at least 100 times taller than the tallest conch structure anywhere in the archipelago, and it still gave him a bracing sense of vertigo. But the ship was much closer to the shore than he had realized, clearly an appendage of the colony rather than a distant looming guardian. If the ship did not exactly look fragile, he now understood that it was a human artifact all the same, as much at the mercy of the ocean as the settlements it overlooked. The ship had brought them to Ararat, before submerging its lower extremities in a kilometer of sea. There were a handful of shuttles capable of carrying people to and from interplanetary space, but the ship was the only thing that could take them beyond Ararat's system, into interstellar space. Vasco had known this since he was small, but until this moment he had never quite grasped how terribly dependent they were on this one means of escape. As the shuttle fell lower, the lights resolved into windows, street lamps, and the open fires of bazaars. There was an unplanned shantytown aspect to most of the districts of First Camp. The largest structures were made from conch material that had washed up on the shore, or been recovered from the sea by foraging expeditions. The resulting buildings had the curved and chambered look of vast seashells. But it was very rare to find conch material in such sizes, and so most of the structures were made of more traditional materials. There were a handful of inflatable domes, some of which were almost as large as the conch structures, but the plastics used to make and repair the domes had always been in short supply. It was much easier to scavenge metal from the heart of the ship. That was why almost everything else was lashed together from sheet metal and scaffolding, forming a low urban sprawl of sagging rectangular structures, seldom reaching more than 3 stories high. The domes and conch structures erupted through the metal slums like blisters. Streets were webs of ragged shadow, unlit save for the occasional torch-bearing pedestrian. The shuttle slid over some intervening regions of darkness and then came to hover above a small outlying formation of structures that Vasco had never seen before. There was a dome and a surrounding accretion of metal structures, but the whole ensemble looked a good deal more formal than any other part of the town. Vasco realized that it was almost certainly one of the administration's hidden encampments. The body of humans and pigs that ran the colony had offices in the city, but it was also a matter of public knowledge that they had secure meeting places not marked on any civilian map. Remembering Clavain's instructions, Vasco made the window seal itself up again and then waited for the touchdown. He barely noticed it when it came, but suddenly his 2 companions were clambering down the length of the cabin, back towards the boarding ramp. Belatedly, Vasco realized that the shuttle had never had a pilot. They stepped down onto an apron of fused rock. Floodlights had snapped on at the last minute, bathing everyone in icy blue. Clavain still wore his coat, but he had also donned a shapeless black hood tugged from the recesses of the collar. The hood's low, wide cowl threw his face into shadow. He was barely recognizable as the man they had met on the island. During the flight, Scorpio had taken the opportunity to clean him up a little, trimming his beard and hair as neatly as circumstances allowed.
"Son," Clavain said, "try not to stare at me with quite that degree of messianic fervor, will you?"
"I didn't mean anything, sir."
Scorpio patted Vasco on the back. Act normally. As far as you're concerned, he's just some stinking old hermit we found wandering around.
The compound was full of machines. Of obscure provenance, they squatted around the shuttle or loomed as vague suggestions in the dark interstices between the floodlights. There were wheeled vehicles, one or two hovercraft, a kind of skeletal helicopter. Vasco made out the sleek surfaces of two other aerial craft parked on the edge of the apron. He could not tell if they were the type that could reach orbit, as well as fly in the atmosphere.
"How many operational shuttles?" Clavain asked.
Scorpio answered after a moment's hesitation, perhaps wondering how much he should say in Vasco's presence.
"Four," he said.
Clavain walked on for half a dozen paces before saying, "There were five or six when I left.
We can't afford to lose shuttles, Scorp. We're doing our best with very limited resources. Some of them may fly again, but I can't promise anything."
Scorpio was leading them towards the nearest of the low metal structures around the dome's perimeter. As they walked away from the shuttle, many of the shadowy machines began to trundle towards it, extending manipulators or dragging umbilical cables across the ground. The way they moved made Vasco imagine injured sea monsters hauling ruined tentacles across dry land.
"If we need to leave quickly," Clavain said, "could we do it? Could any of the other ships be used? Once the zodiacal light arrives, they only have to reach orbit. I'm not asking for full spaceworthiness, just something that will make a few trips."
"Zodiacal light will have its own shuttles," Scorpio said, "and even if it doesn't, we still have the only ship we need to reach orbit."
"You'd better hope and pray we never have to use it," Clavain said.
"By the time we need the shuttles," Scorpio said, "we'll have contingencies in place. The time we need them might be this evening. Has that occurred to you?"
They had arrived at the entrance to the cordon of structures surrounding the dome. As they approached it, another pig stepped out into the night, moving with the exaggerated side-to-side swagger common to his kind. He was shorter and stockier than Scorpio, if such a thing were possible. His shoulders were so massive and yoke-like that his arms hung some distance from the sides of his body, swinging like pendulums when he walked. He looked as if he could pull a man from limb to limb. The pig glared at Vasco, deep frown lines notching his brow.
"Looking at something, kid?"
Vasco hurried out his answer. "No, sir."
"Relax, blood," Scorpio said.
"Vasco's had a busy day. He's just a bit overwhelmed by it all. Right, son?"
"Yes, sir."
The pig called Blood nodded at Clavain.
"Good to have you back, old guy."
Approaching Hela, 2615. Quaish was still close enough to Morwenna for real-time communication.
"You won't like what I'm going to do," he said, "but this is for the good of both of us."
Her reply came after a crackle of static.
"You promised you wouldn't be long."
"I still intend to keep that promise. I'm not going to be gone 1 minute longer than I said. This is more about you than me, actually."
"How so?"
she asked.
"I'm worried there might be something down on Hela apart from the bridge. I've been picking up a metallic echo and it hasn't gone away. Could be nothing. Probably is nothing. But I can't take the chance that it might be a booby trap. I've encountered this kind of thing before and it makes me nervous."
"Then turn around," Morwenna said.
"I'm sorry, but I can't. I really need to check out this bridge. If I don't come back with something good, Jasmina's going to have me for breakfast."
He would leave it to Morwenna to figure out what that would mean for her, still bedded in the scrimshaw suit with Grelier her only hope of escape.
"But you can't just walk into a trap," Morwenna said.
"I'm more worried about you, frankly. The daughter will take care of me, but if I trigger something it might start taking pot shots at anything it sees, up to and including the dominatrix."
"So what are you going to do?"
"I thought about having you pull away from the Haldora Hela system, but that would waste too much time and fuel. I've got a better idea. We'll use what we've been given. Haldora is a nice fat shield. It's just sitting there doing nothing. I'm going to put it between you and whatever's on Hela. Make some bloody use of the thing."
Morwenna considered the implications for a few seconds. There was a sudden urgency in her voice.
"But that will mean..."
"Yes, we'll be out of line of sight contact, so we won't be able to talk to each other. But it'll only be for a few hours. 6 at the most."
He got that in before she could protest further.
"I'll program the dominatrix to wait behind Haldora for 6 hours.
then returned to its present position relative to Hela. Not so bad, is it? Get some sleep, and you'll barely realize I'm gone.
Don't do this, Horace. I don't want to be in a place where I can't talk to you.
It's only for 6 hours.
When she responded, she did not sound any calmer, but he could hear the shift in pitch in her voice that meant she had at least accepted the futility of argument.
But if something happens in that time, if you need me, or I need you, we won't be able to talk.
Only for 6 hours, he said. 300 minutes or so. Nothing. Be done in a flash.
Can't you drop some relays, so we can still keep in touch?
Don't think so. I could sew some passive reflectors around Haldora, but that's exactly the kind of thing that might lead a smart missile back to you. Anyway, it would take a couple of hours to get them into position. I could be down under the bridge by then.
I'm frightened, Horace. I really don't want you to do this.
I have to, he said. I just have to.
Please don't.
I'm afraid the plan is already underway, Quaish replied gently. I've sent the necessary commands to the Dominatrix. It's moving, love. It'll be inside Haldora's shadow in about 30 minutes. There was silence. He thought for a moment that the link might already have broken, that his calculations had been in error. But then she said,
"So why did you bother to ask me if you'd already made up your mind?"